got chickens in the houses, they got chickens in the trees. Chicken in the pots, the Mottawog, the Petaloomies. Out in Petaluma, spending my days. Oh, I'm out in Petaluma, spending my days. Tell me, how many eggs will a chicken lay? Now Marvin got me started, sold me my first hen. Now I got 4 and 20 and 24 more again. I'm out in Petaluma, spending my days. Oh, I'm out in Petaluma, spending my days. Tell me, how many eggs will a chicken lay? In the morning, it's chicken in the night. Weren't for chicken, Petaluma never would have reached its height. I'm out in Petaluma, spending my days. Oh, I'm out in Petaluma, spending my days. Tell me, how many eggs will a chicken lay?
Good evening and welcome to Mouthful, Smart Talk about food, wine, and farming in Sonoma County and beyond. It is KRCB Radio 91. It's Michelle Anna Jordan live in the studio, awake, not sick. What a great day. Happy Mother's Day to you. And how many eggs does a chicken lay? Norman Greenbaum asks in that song. And I have to tell you, they've been laying a lot lately. If you have not been shopping at farmers markets, now is a really good time to check it out, because several vendors, I think at all markets, have pullet eggs right now. And pullet eggs are from the younger chickens when they are just, you know, they're not yet fully mature. They're like teenagers. And they're laying eggs. Their eggs are typically, not always, but typically smaller than they will be when they're fully mature. But inside that small shell, there is a greater percentage of yolk to white. And so they are very, very rich. They are very rich, very delicious. They make, I got a double yolked pullet egg this morning. Wow. They make fabulous poached eggs, which is what I had for breakfast. They also make fabulous smashed egg salad, deviled egg salad. I made deviled egg salad for 150 people. I made a gallon of deviled egg salad just two or three weeks ago. And it was a really hot day and people ate about a pint total, maybe 2 pints. I ate egg salad every day for a week and I never got tired of it. But seriously, check out, you know, I don't know if any of my guests know how long a chicken is a pullet. I think maybe 3 or 4 months. It's not a big window. And there have been pullet eggs now for several weeks. So check out some pullet eggs. You're not going to find them in a grocery store. You got to go to the farmer's market or to a farm stand for pullet eggs. So that's the hot tip. That's one of the hot tips for today. Another hot tip is, the season is coming on really, really fast. Lots of foods are much earlier than you would expect. There have been apricots at farmers markets for at least 2 weeks. There have been cherries for 3 or 4 weeks. There are some peaches and some nectarines. And one of the things that this means, other than don't blink or you'll miss apricots, but one of this means things that this sort of speeded up harvest means is that we're probably not going to have a really long season with fresh favas. So if you want some fresh fava beans, which are so delicious, you got to get them now. Because when it gets warm, they fatten up and then they toughen up and they harden and they're still good, but they become dried beans rather than the beautiful, tender little green jewels of fresh favas. I've been eating them practically every day. On that note, let's see what my guests have been eating. We have returning from at least one visit, prior visit, maybe two, Ruth Lefkowitz of Ruthie's Real Meals, which is both a delivery service and a takeout.
Thanks, hi, Michelle.
It's great to have you here again.
Thanks so much.
And we also have Lindy Baker, and we are going to talk about a couple different things. First, we're going to talk about how Ruthie's Real Meals has grown and what it's doing today. And she brought some nibbles. But then we're also going to talk about her mom, her mom's cooking, and we're going to talk about Lindy's mom's cooking. And is it also your aunts? Your aunts? Who was it somebody had two kitchens, a kosher kitchen and a...
Those were my great aunts.
Oh, great aunts. Okay.
Great aunts. Yes. They had definitely their own view of how food should be handled and eaten.
Mm-hmm. Cool. So that, and it's that how we're influenced by the women who raise us is the Mother's Day portion of the theme. And we will, of course, have mother-related music. And you have no idea what I have gone through today to bring that to you. It was a great feat that had a really silly, simple solution. Thank you, Mike, Mouthful's engineer, for pulling a rabbit out of the hat at the last minute. So let's start with Ruth. Let's explore your business, because you opened a place. You'd been doing the delivery for a while.
Yes, for about I've had the business for 9 years.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, 2007. And about 2 years ago, I moved into a retail location in Cotati, on 116 on the west side of 101.
Are you by, what is it, Johnny Java's?
Yeah, in the Johnny
Java. Yeah, you're
Johnny's
almost
Java
next door,
shopping,
right?
Center. I'm next door to Lynn's Thai, which
oh,
is a
okay,
Thai
Lynn's
restaurant
Thai,
a lot of people
yes.
like. So we're neighbors, and there's also a Vietnamese, a good Vietnamese restaurant in there, too, and Johnny's Java. And I think that's it for the food portion of the shopping
so Johnny center. Johnny Java's has a readily available bathroom. If you yeah. are meeting people at Park and Ride and they are late.
Right, and they
you
open
can
it,
run in there.
Right, they open at 4 in the morning, I believe.
Oh, perfect.
Right.
So how is the takeout business going?
You know, it's going well. I have a lot of regulars, actually, who come for... We have a refrigerated case that people can, you know, pick our entrees and take them home and heat them up kind of thing. One of the challenges that that it makes it difficult in a retail situation is that our menu changes every week. So it's hard to have a fixed menu that people can just return for certain
sure.
items that they want, which is totally understandable. But often, you know, they'll get something 1 week and they'll come back and it's not there the next week. So
So your food's all seasonal?
Well, it's not necessarily. I mean, I try to do, you know, I do observe the seasons to some extent, but, you know, many things kind of have multiple, like they're seasonal throughout the year to some extent. But even so, our menu changes every week. And then we do shift to seasonal things. You know, things like asparagus, you know, we only serve in the springtime. But many, you know, other things like beets, roasted beet salad, you can pretty much make that almost any time of the year.
You know, I think that's a really good point, because that's one of the, if you're putting together a cookbook and you want to emphasize seasonality, it's impossible to do it in just straight ahead spring, summer, fall, winter chapters. You have to come up with a way to represent those things that cross over seasons.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, right, they're the conventionally thought of things as
sure,
seasonal,
like asparagus,
or
artichokes,
raspberries,
cherries.
Or, yeah, right.
Sure. But I mean, even raspberries in Sonoma County, we now get local raspberries usually about late May, early June, and one or two farms has them until Thanksgiving.
Okay, yeah, so that's a very long season.
Yeah, and so there's just, I think of that just because I've been working on something that has required me to figure out how to represent that, and
right.
I think I finally figured it out.
Okay.
So, but yeah, it's because, you know, asparagus doesn't, and, you know, the day that summer, you know, ends. You know, there's just lots and lots of amorphous boundaries rather than firm boundaries. So what you get at the takeout, and it's called Ruthie's, right?
Yeah, Ruthie's Real Meals.
That's the same menu that you were also preparing and delivering.
Yes, and so that's, you know, that's what changes every week. And we, you know, we have a couple of meat, fish or chicken entrees a week, a couple of vegetarian entrees every week, and then, you know, three or four sides, two salads, one or two soups, and different desserts. Some of the items, you know, like dessert items, we kind of keep in stock.
Mm-hmm. Probably so, always have to have one that's
right.
Chocolate.
Yeah, I have, you know, I always have cookies, and certain cookies we always have. So. Uh-huh. But the other desserts can also be, you know, on that weekly menu, so we have them or we don't have them.
Mm-hmm. One thing I'm curious about, in 2007, when you started, I'm wondering what the evolution in what people have wanted, what people want from you. Because in 2007, we didn't have Fever Pitch gluten-free.
That's true.
And there's some other things. Yeah. That, I mean, we had, see, what was it? Well, we were still kind of fat. People were still pretty fat phobic in 2007, though not as bad as in the 90s. So
right.
I'm curious, what trends have you noticed fade or appear?
I mean, we do make a lot of gluten-free options, and if something does have, you know, does have flour or breadcrumbs in it, I can make a gluten-free version. Now mm-hmm. It's pretty easy.
Yeah.
And actually, I've begun thickening pretty much most of my sauces that are thick, like gravy-like sauces. I just use a gluten-free flour or...
You found one that works?
I actually use brown rice flour, and that's...
It will stay in... It will stay emulsified?
It stays emulsified, and even when you heat it, and the flavor, it's not... It doesn't have a strong taste. Mm-hmm. You don't get... It's not as creamy as, like, a flour gravy, but it's actually great, and I, you know, I can get organic brown rice flour, mm-hmm. and so that's what I pretty much use for all my those kinds of sauces.
Yeah, because I had to make one year. This was a few years ago, before there were so many things. Like now, you can get, I'm sure you know, gluten free panko.
Right, right.
But this was real early on, and I was at a friend's house for both Thanksgiving and Christmas, and I had to make turkey gravy and then gravy for prime rib. I have no idea what the gluten-free flour they provided me was, but it was horrid. Right. It was so bad. It absorbed nothing. It did not stay emulsified.
Okay, yeah.
So it's really great that there's been these improvements.
Yeah, it's, you know, there's tapioca starch or brown rice flour.
What about, does potato starch work?
Potato starch can work for certain things. Mm-hmm. It's not as binding. It wouldn't make that, I mean, it would... The gravy would be a little different.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, but I've also used actually just gluten-free cake flour, mm-hmm. which is usually a combination of different flours, and I've used that to thicken as well. So.
Uh-huh.
But for your original question around what do people eat, is I find there's often a disconnect between what people say they want to eat and what they actually want to eat, which is more of the... maybe more fattening things or, you know, things that have ingredients in them that you might think people wouldn't want, like, you know, mayonnaise, potato salad with the mayonnaise type base or just, you know, people, what I find people want to eat in their homes is just, you know, comfort foods that, and as long as it's prepared well with mm-hmm. high quality ingredients, that seems to be more important than, you know, like we sell a lot of meatloaf, but it's organic. You know, I use organic ground
meats,
beef, and and then organic vegetable. You know, the carrot, celery, onion, and garlic, and all that.
Mm-hmm.
So you know that people like that. We make meatloaf sandwiches that are great.
Mm-hmm. Have you used cow fat in anything?
No, I haven't, but. Because I do a lot of vegetarian cooking, if it doesn't have cheese in it, I usually use olive oil to mm-hmm. as an oil.
Because cow fat, I got very excited about call fat when I was writing my book on meatballs, mm-hmm. and you saying meatloaf made right. me think of it because I just tested a meatloaf by wrapping it.
Okay.
And, call fat looks like a lace curtain.
Right.
And it used to only be available in like 25 or 50 pound boxes. But now with the new butchery movement, you can buy any amount from Sonoma Meat Company or from Thistle Meats.
Okay.
And you can wrap your meatballs or you can wrap meatloaf in call fat, and there's no gluten, and it holds in all the juices.
Oh, okay,
I put that all. And actually, if you go back in history, 2,000 years ago, the first meatballs, which were called minces, they were wrapped in call fat. Because
so you can wrap the individual meatballs as well.
Oh, like absolutely!
Absolutely! It just adheres. The call fat.
You cut a square, okay, triangle, right. Whatever shape. You know, I just spread out a sheet and I use ice cream scooper for whatever size, and I put the meatballs on it, and then I cut and wrap them.
Oh my god, that sounds good.
And it's cheap. You can wrap maybe 300 small meatballs with a pound or less, and a pound. God, I paid $5.99 a pound for call fat. Mm-hmm. I just keep it in my freezer in like 3 ounce portions, and if I decide I want to make some meatballs, thaws out in 10 minutes, and it's very inexpensive. And then you just have to not put in anything if you're going for gluten free. So I was trying to figure out how I could not compromise.
So you're using that to replace what you would normally use as a binder inside the meatball.
No, I use it. You know how a lot of meatballs, if you read conventional contemporary recipes, roll it in flour, dip it in an egg, and then roll it in breadcrumbs is the typical way that most people write recipes for meatballs. And I didn't want to do it that way. I thought there would be something, because those things don't enhance the taste. And I thought there must be something. And I'd had crepinettes. And there's one other one. I always forget the name. It's very similar. Cayettes and crepinettes from France, all different regions of France. And that's the first time I had call fat. I had this amazing veal crepinette. It was so good at the junior college where I was teaching. And I thought, okay, this call fat thing is pretty awesome. And then I saw it for sale retail. I was like, okay, I'm trying. And it's just so easy. And then I sort of went backwards from there, thinking, okay, this is by definition without gluten, and it actually tastes better as well. So why don't I take the breadcrumbs out of the meatball and see what happens? Breadcrumbs really were only, they weren't the binder, they were the filler. And so I experimented with no fillers and also with other fillers, such as rice. So anyway, call fat's awesome.
Does it brown up when you...
if you fry it, yeah.
Okay.
It browns up beautifully.
Right.
Or in the oven.
In the oven, that's what I say.
Yeah.
That's how I usually do it.
And it's nice because it's... Most of the fat, the lacy part, the thicker part, that fat melts away. That will go into the pan, typically go into the pan. But the thin membrane that you can actually see through, that doesn't melt away, but it tightens up. And you have just a little bit of toothsomeness when you bite into it, and it's very delicious and a beautiful texture.
Nice.
I'm changing. I want to make call fat popular again. I'm on a mission.
That's your mission.
It's one of my missions.
Have to change the name.
Oh, yeah. We could call it, like lacy curtain.
Lacy curtain wrappers.
Yes, there we go. Anyway. There's my contribution. How many clients do you typically have in a week?
We have about 30.
And that's for the home delivery.
Yeah, for the home delivery, 30 to 35 or so individuals or households.
Mm-hmm. And is it, do they order for the week? Do they order one meal? Is it a plan that they do?
Well, the ordering is a la carte. So we have an online website and you can order, choose your entrees or sides and all that. But people order enough, $75 or $100 worth of food, and that usually lasts them for 3 or 4 days.
Okay. And then do they, when you say up 30, 35, Are those repeat customers?
A lot of repeat customers. Yeah, we have, you know, most of the people who order every week. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, some people are just do it when they need it, or mm-hmm. there's a lot of gifts, a lot of gifting of the mm-hmm. service for new parents or mm-hmm.
It's a great thing for new parents.
Or for old parents.
Yeah. But in fact, I'm thinking of a friend who just came home from the hospital, I think today. She's got, a 2.5-year-old, and she just had her second baby.
Okay, yeah.
And I thought, God, what a nice gift that would be.
Yeah, actually, really at the Sonoma County Open Space District, they've had, I think, their fifth employee has gone out on maternity and paternity leave. And all the coworkers chip in and get a several hundred dollar worth gift certificate from my service.
So, oh, how nice.
And new parents are like, oh, they can't wait to get that certificate.
Tell us your website.
It's ruthiesrealmeals.com.
And it's Ruthie with a Y?
With a Y.
Ruthie's.
And don't put the apostrophe in the URL.
Yes, you can. You have to use bad grammar for URLs. Well, right. We are going to switch topics to talking about moms, aunts, and their kitchens. But first, we're going to take a musical break with... Go to your radio or however you're listening. I want you to turn this up. Sit down, pour yourself a beer if you have one, and just let the story unfold. It is one of my all-time favorite songs, and you don't hear it very often.
Mama hated diesel so bad. I guess I knew something to do with Dad. The first I ever seen her cry was after one of them things went by. Mama hated diesel so bad. I remember hearing those semi-gear and dang. My mom and me, we lived right on the high grade into town. Well, I sure liked them white freight liners, but there was something in Mama's eye when she'd catch me watching the road. Your little bitty piece of her die. Mama hated diesel so bad. I guess I knew it was something to do with Dad. The first I ever seen her cry was after one of them things. Mama hated diesel so bad. As the years passed and I grew older, Mama did too. Pretty soon she stopped singing and laughing, or she'd hardly even eat. And I began staying away from home on the weekdays. I wouldn't come home from school till way past dark. I was too busy having some kind of fun, either messing around with some gal or hanging around the local truck stop, talking with my buddies about all the big rigs that are all the time rolling in, and talking about all the crazy places we've never been, like California. But one day the county sheriff come up to me. He said they found my mama wandering all by herself in the middle of the highway crying. She was trying, of all things, Lord, to flag down one of them big old rigs with a pocket handkerchief. Well, that left me on my own. I got a job unloaded rigs down at the local freight yard. Pretty soon I had a rig of my own, and I left my hometown on my very first run to Frisco. Well, that was 3 years ago today, and I ain't been back home in all that time since then till now. Now it's me and the local preacher standing in the graveyard grass, staring down at the highway, watching those big boys pass. Well, he laid his hand upon me and he prayed for quite some time that I could barely understand the words he said behind that highway's whine. Then he handed me a faded photograph. He said he found it in my mama's hand. He said, son, I'm afraid that you in this picture was the best your mama ever had. Well, I looked down at that picture. It was mama and some guy standing in front of a semi-truck, just married, painted on the side. Mama hated diesel so bad. I guess I knew it was something to do with Dad. The first I ever seen her cry was after one of them things went by. Mama hated diesel so bad. Mama hated diesel so bad.
Mama hated diesels. If you're the kind who goes to YouTube, you might check out the Bill Kirchen version. Really quite recent. A tiny bit more up-tempo than that, but God, such a great song. Okay, we're going to bring Lindy into the conversation now. Lindy says, SEZ.com.
That's correct.
Tell us about the website.
Well, what do you want to know about it? It's a food website. I'm the writer, editor, and recipe developer for it.
When did you start it?
I started it in 2007, so about the same time as she started her business, and have found a great deal of difference from when I started blogging about food and what is happening today with the 2 bazillion people that are blogging about food, mostly vegan, gluten-free, paleo, all the little niches are being addressed. I'm none of the above, but many of my recipes are of that genre. And, you know, but I think that we need to eat everything. And that is what makes the world healthy and makes us healthy and happy, is to encourage ourselves to experiment with food and fresh food.
That's pretty much my philosophy. You know, eat everything unless it'll kill you.
As the Julia Child philosophy, right?
Yeah.
Everything in moderation.
Everything in moderation. If something will kill you, don't make a big deal of it. Just don't eat it.
That's right. If it's going to kill you, you know. So the whole gluten-free movement has me a little, you know, conflicted, because if you truly have the disease, celiac disease, and you can't eat gluten, then absolutely. But it's become such a buzzword. And
well, it's just like the fat phobes in the 80s, where people would run in the opposite direction if they saw a piece of cheese.
Yes.
Oh, do you still use alcohol? I never touch salt. By the way, can you tell me, my soups never taste good. They always taste flat. When do you add the salt? I never use salt.
Right. Well, okay. There you go.
Yep.
Exactly. I love people when they comment that, you know, they didn't like a recipe, but then they really didn't make the recipe that you wrote. They added this and they didn't have that, so they put this in instead. And it gets quite humorous sometimes to read comments from people.
We could probably, like, I'll never forget the hummus someone made for my cookbook. Well, I don't like fat, so I didn't put any tahini, and garlic is just too strong for me. I didn't put any lemon juice or olive oil either, but there's a little bit of cumin, like you suggested. What do you think?
It probably wasn't very good.
Yeah, she put a taste in my mouth, and it was, oh, my God. I'm smiling. Yeah. Oh, okay. So, is that what you do now full-time? Is it a side thing? Or?
Well, it's actually what I do full-time. I'm developing that, as well as a couple of my husband and I are working on food and wine pairing and education and how to do food and wine pairings. But this is what I do. I'm trying to write my first cookbook. You have that under your belt, a number of them, excellent cookbooks.
Thank you.
I know it's a a labor of love and a lot of work.
Oh, you mean as opposed to a labor of economics? I love writing. You set me down at my desk and I write. I love cooking. I love writing.
Well, I used to be, when I first started in 2007, I could put a recipe out there and I didn't have to have a photograph of it.
Now you do.
I could just write a recipe. I could put it in my blog and, you know, make cute little titles and a cute little story. And, you know, it was okay. Oh, now, no, you have to be a master photographer and really get that sexy picture in there along with the recipe, or people are just kind of going to bypass it.
But, you know, that has also changed in the world of cookbooks.
Yes.
Hugely. And it's changed in two ways. You know, the first number of my books didn't have photographs, had illustrations, and even so, there was still a budget from the publisher for illustrations. And then when I started having some photographs in my books, photo budget, no problem. Not just a budget for the photographer, but a budget for the food costs, a budget for the stylist. My last six cookbooks, I had to provide all of the photographs. I had to provide all the food for the photographs, and I had zero budget. And that is getting to be the standard. And part of the reason it's getting to be the standard is because, well, two things, bloggers and digital.
Yes.
So it's really, it's tough right now. And you really do, if you don't have good photography skills, you have to hustle.
And you have to take pictures of everything you eat and put it on Instagram so people know what you're doing. It's really a very interesting movement and how it's changed, like I said, from when I first started. You know, it's really much more intense SEO, trying to get your little niche.
Do you do the SEO yourself?
I do my own SEO. I do the whole thing. It's a one-woman show right now, learning the photography, trying to get everything up and coming up with the new recipes because, as we all know, you know, there's only so many notes in music, there's only so many ingredients to work with, and it's just a matter of how you put them together to come up with your final product.
Yeah.
How often do you write? Oh, sorry.
No, you go ahead.
How often do you publish? I try
to make most of the time, once a week. Okay. I publish one recipe a week because by the time I come up with the recipe, do the photography, process the photography so that it looks beautiful, and then write it all up and then write my blog piece, my information, my story, so to speak. It's a full week. I take the weekends off unless I'm cooking something that I'm going to take pictures of. And my family has learned to eat semi-cold food on days when...
You're photographing?
When I'm photographing.
Oh, yeah. What kind of camera do you use?
I use a Nikon 5300 with a 50mm.
That's what I use, a Nikon 5300. I went out and bought myself a good camera.
Yeah, I love it. It's really easy to use once you get used to changing all the apertures and figure out what an aperture is.
Do you take classes?
I've been taking some online classes, but I found that the biggest help has been just to take pictures.
Do it, yeah. I've taken a couple classes at Shutterbug. And, you know, I really want to take a couple more.
They're very good at Shutterbug for landscape, I found. But food photography is very, it's different.
It is. It's very different. What I want to do is I just really want to get to know my camera better.
Right.
And that's what I think they've been really helpful for. Because with this new website, my website isn't, I mean, I'm going to be doing recipes on my website, but the cooking section of the website is just one portion of it.
Right.
It's much bigger in scope than that, and it's going to be a full-time job.
Well, the only thing I can suggest is take, just shoot everything.
Everything.
Every single thing. You put something down in front of yourself and set it up and try to take your photos. Because it's digital, you can just throw them away.
Oh, yeah. Toss
them.
Thousands and thousands of photographs in my three computers. But yeah, that's actually that's the final piece that needs to go into place is my own photography. I've been using mostly other people's photography for the beta. We're doing a beta lunch probably in about 10 days, 7 to 10 days.
That can get expensive.
And then, actually I've been very lucky.
Oh, have you?
Good. Yes, yes. I've done favors for lots of people over the years. And I continue to do lots of favors for people over the years. And, I mean, in fair, you know, fair things. And there are people who are happy to let me use their photographs, and I will, of course, have links to their work. So, and I'm just getting one-time use rights. And then if the site becomes monetized, I'll be able to pay for some photography.
Yeah.
We'll see. But now, let's talk about kitchens. Your mama's kitchen. You have four siblings.
Yes.
Your mama didn't love cooking, but she kept you fed.
She did keep all of us fed.
And she fed you kosher.
Yes, which, requires having two sets of everything, two sets of dishes, two sets of pots and pans, one that you use with dairy meals and one that you use with meals that have any kind of meat in them.
Could you have just one refrigerator, or did you need two?
One refrigerator.
Okay, one refrigerator.
But all the, and then when the holiday of Passover rolls around, which just happened, you have a second set of two sets of everything.
Oh, really?
So you change out your entire kitchen.
Oh, I didn't know that. I did not know
Passover.
That.
That's the, you're cleansing out the, you know, the leavened bread thing, mm-hmm. and, you know, getting out all the you know, all the utensils that you use with that, and bringing in the ones that have never had like any kinds of breads.
Oh,
just, you know,
so that's the foundation for Passover. Nothing leavened,
right? That was the story of.
Yeah, know, I knew the story, but Passover. I didn't know if that was quite the foundation.
Well, I guess it's more. Darn, this is totally not my subject, but it's, you know. Has to do with slavery,
right?
And
yeah, sure.
Egypt,
and you know, not being able to have fleeing,
being
right?
In the desert for 4 years,
right?
So all that. So they made matzah in a hurry.
I think Passover was when God Lord was going to kill the firstborn son.
Yes,
of every
family. That was one, among other
right
things.
But the Passover was when they put the blood on the
yes.
the lintel of the door.
Yes,
and the angel of death passed over that house.
Yes,
you know, that gives me chills, and it gives me chills because when I was 4 or 5, my mother took me to see a movie. It might have been King of Kings. I'm not sure, but our church, the church that she took me to at the time, they gave passes out for this movie around Easter. And there was the blood on the door, and then there were soldiers putting knives through babies.
Oh, yeah.
And I had nightmares about that.
I can imagine.
For years, and it's still just like,
wow,
yeah, really disturbing stuff. But no leaven, no tools that have touched leaven,
right.
Leavening.
Yes.
That's really interesting. Yes. So, and she did this with 5 kids. You must have had some huge cupboards or garage or something where you had all the dishes stored?
I don't know. You know, we didn't live in a real big house. I don't know. My mom just managed it. She's a Virgo.
Oh, there you go.
So she was able to do it. But one of the things I feel like that gives me an advantage in my business is the ability to distinguish between a lot of different things, like the ability to keep things separate. You know, we prepare like 3 or 4 versions of many things,
mm-hmm.
you know, like a gluten-free version, a no onion version if there's somebody who wants that or whatever. And you kind of like set it up so that you have your base, and then, you know, you take it out before you add this or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
So you're kind of working with those kinds of constraints sometimes.
Uh-huh.
And I feel like I see how it was done. Like, I grew mm-hmm. up in a household where you could do that, and, you know, so it's not really that intimidating.
Interesting. I find everything about the Jewish culture, but especially everything about the Jewish culture connected to food, I just find it really interesting.
Well, it does. I mean, it does have a long history. You know, the Jewish calendar is, you know, it's 5,700 mm-hmm. or so years running. So
there's always a story. You know, there's always some sort of story, and either like with Passover, some of the other holidays,
yeah,
but even some of the dishes, you get somebody talking about their rugelah or something, and you'll go back and hear stories about various generations. I find it really fascinating.
Yeah, I'm not super connected in with that, mm-hmm. that part of cooking for me, or even being that necessarily connected to the cultural or religious aspects of Judaism now in my life.
Yeah. Yeah, it's just something, even as a kid, I just found it interesting. I want to bring you in, because you had the two great aunts who had the two kitchens.
Yeah, well, they lived together, and they had the two kitchens. I visited them once when I was 16, so I'm not really sure how much of this is true memory and how much of this is 16-year-old with American girl visiting her grandmother in Germany and going to dinner with these two aunts, and all this in German, and picking up little tiny pieces of here and there. But they did have two kitchens, and one was electric and one was gas, and they each had their own cooking. And my one aunt didn't eat what my other aunt cooked, but they sat at the table together. So they each went to their own kitchen and cooked their own food, and then they sat down together and ate their meals, so to speak. And if they had guests, my Tante Betty would cook for her guest, and my Tante Sonia would cook for her guest, and they would sit down
together.
And if the guest wanted to eat something from one of the other plates, it was okay, but they did not share food. But they lived together for almost 30 years. Wow.
And these were your mom's?
My mother's aunts.
Okay.
Yes.
And so was your mother was born in Germany?
My mother was born in Germany. She came to the United States after the war. My father was an American GI.
Oh, okay. And tell me about her cooking, because you said you ate differently than people you knew.
Yes. Well, we had things such as pot roasts and fresh carrots and potatoes. And our neighbors, I was kind of jealous as a child, because they ate Cheerios and peanut butter and jelly sandwiches for dinner, you know, a hot dog occasionally. But we had to go home and actually sit down to a family meal that was, you know, cooked meats and potatoes and fresh vegetables and cabbage. And the people in the neighborhood thought, you know, the kids especially thought we were pretty nutty people.
Well, fresh vegetables were not on the American table from about, really up until the 70s.
Yeah, my mother talks about going to the grocery store, and you had the choice of, a russet or a white potato.
Mm-hmm.
You had carrots, you had cabbage, you had apples, you had iceberg lettuce.
If you were really in a sophisticated area, you might have romaine.
You might have romaine. Now, my mother grew tomatoes in the backyard. Mm-hmm. So during the summertime, we had fresh tomatoes, which to this day is my favorite time of the year.
Oh, yeah.
Bring me my tomatoes. I will not eat them any other time of the year.
Oh, no, not at all.
We also were backed up to a electrical field, and our farm, there was a farmer who was allowed the contract to farm underneath the high power poles by Edison. So we had acres and acres and acres of fresh corn during the summer, which we were allowed to go over the fence. We had permission from the farmer to go
that
over the fence.
That was the one fresh vegetable you saw in America.
Yes.
Fresh vegetables and fresh tomatoes.
Right. And then in the wintertime, we had celery in the same area.
Mm.
So we could also go over and grab celery. So when I was a child, though, we used to go to school, walk by these fields, grab a piece of celery off the stalk, wash it off in the irrigation ditch, eat it on the way to school, not realizing, of course, in the day they were spraying the fields with DDT.
Oh, my gosh, yeah.
So the runoff that we were cleaning our celery in was probably full of DDT. So probably not the healthiest piece of celery I ever ate in my life, but I'm still standing.
You are still standing, and you look really healthy. it's interesting to think about that evolution, because now we just take fresh vegetables for granted. And what is available even in grocery stores and, like, mainstream grocery stores is pretty astonishing when you compare it to what was available really up until the 70s.
And you bring someone from Europe. We've had hosted Italian bike riders for Colavita USA's race team, and we take them to the grocery store, and they look at our produce, and they are just blown away by the variety that we have in California. They might have a lot more fresh vegetables there than they used to, but they certainly don't have star fruits, and they don't have, you know, as many choices mm-hmm. of vegetables, which we mm-hmm. are very lucky in our supermarkets to mm-hmm. get.
One thing I did eat as a child, and I don't know why this happened, and I've always wondered, artichokes. So my mother was, she was born in Napa, but she was raised in Illinois. And some of my earliest memories growing up in the Bay Area, we're eating fresh artichokes.
No, because you got castor oil, right?
But, you know, that wasn't common around where I was growing up. I didn't see a lot of other people. I don't know if I saw anybody with artichokes. And I don't know where that artichoke influence came from. And I know when I was growing up, I never saw asparagus, fresh asparagus. My mother loved canned asparagus, and I could not even be in the same room because it smelled so bad. So that I don't like asparagus, no. And all of a sudden, there's this fresh asparagus here, and I tried it. So it was in the 70s, and
I was like,
wow.
That with cauliflower and broccoli as a child because it was frozen. My grandmother, when I went to Germany and I lived with her for 3 months, had fresh cauliflower. Uh-huh. It was the first time I'd ever had fresh cauliflower. And she soaked it in salted ice water for an hour before she cooked it. And it took away all the sulfur.
Oh, yeah.
The flavoring
all the sulfur
of it.
Compounds.
Yeah.
Compounds.
So it really changed it. So if you don't like cauliflower, try soaking it in ice water with some salt for an hour.
You say the word, and I can feel the metal spoon trying to pry my mouth open. My three-year-old mouth open and shove cauliflower with cream sauce into my poor little mouth. It was, oh, my God.
He's exactly with you.
Oh, it's the one thing there's two things. Oatmeal and cauliflower. Cannot abide them. And it's from early childhood trauma. Actually in chocolate.
Chocolate?
Don't like chocolate. And I know why now. I finally traced it back. I love chocolate, and I had to take cherry-flavored penicillin. Do you remember that? Oh, that's bad stuff. And I didn't want to. So my mother promised me a piece of chocolate cake after I took it, and she put a big piece of chocolate cake with chocolate frosting in my mouth while the penicillin was still in my mouth. And it was so horrible. It was so horrible. I can still taste it when I think about it. And I can take a piece of nice, thin, bittersweet chocolate and enjoy it a couple times a year. But that, overall, it was just, I was too young and too traumatized.
I cannot do mushrooms.
Canned mushrooms?
Mushrooms and cream of mushroom soup. My gosh, those were the most horrible things to chew on and smell and taste. And to this day, I think I've eaten mushrooms a couple of times, morels in fine dining restaurants mm-hmm. where they're really, and they don't seem like mushrooms anymore. Right. But if you put a mushroom, no.
Yeah. This is interesting. The way this conversation has turned is interesting, and I think it's very fitting for Mother's Day because a lot of us didn't learn to cook alongside our mother. A lot of us had to learn to cook later and figure out how to get away from, you know, what we were fed or how we were. I feel sorry for my mother. She didn't have a really very good life, but she was raised in an orphanage after her father died. They did that then, you know. That was very common. Her father died, and the Royal Order of Moose of Napa raised the money and sent my mother, 6 years old, and her brother, who was eight, sent them to Moose Heart in Illinois, and they lived there in dormitories until they graduated from high school. So she wasn't mothered very well, and she didn't learn, you know, she learned how to mother playing with, I think, the one doll she had, but the doll never, grew up and tried to become independent. So she had a little bit of a problem with the growth of a child.
Yes.
And she didn't learn to cook. So, you know, she did, and then she was a widow. So a lot of us are traumatized by how we were That's brought true. Up. And it's going to be interesting to see the generations that are being raised now and all the different ways, because we now have much more of a patchwork quilt right. of eating styles than we did back then.
Well, that's interesting. True. And then there's new ways to learn how to cook, like with blogs like yours. Or one of the things, something that reminded me of when you were talking about your blog is, I don't know if you've seen the little, they're either by this group Tasty or it's a how to cook video, but they're very rapid.
Yes.
Oh, yes.
Shot
Taste, Tasty. Shot, yes. Shot with a GoPro.
Oh, okay. Right. I was.
Yeah. There's two of them that are doing that. It's become very, very popular. I'm not sure if it really teaches anyone how to cook.
It seems like it would be kind of an effective way to learn something quickly, sort of.
Well, yes, I would agree with you. And then I have a lot of friends that don't know how to really
do what they're
cook,
showing.
What they're showing, and it's confusing to them and it frustrates them. I've had yeah. a couple of friends that have gotten those boxes, the grocery boxes that they get, send oh. to your home, that you're supposed to just be able to follow their recipe, everything's included, and they say they can't follow the recipe because it's not written for someone who doesn't know how to cook.
Right.
So when I write my recipes, I want to make sure I'm writing them in the most basic form. Anybody who's never cooked mm-hmm. hopefully can pick up my recipe and do what it is they're supposed to do.
Right, that requires so much of writing, actual writing.
Because you have to think about it.
There are so
it.
Many techniques that you might take for granted. I work
yeah,
with
you
young
can't
people.
Just say saute.
Right,
the,
I work
saute
with
the garlic and olive oil.
And you have to kind of explain sometimes what saute means.
Exactly.
In over medium low
right,
heat, you don't want to brown it. You know, you've got to
and
go.
What sort of pan? You know, right. I find that home cooks, inexperienced home cooks, in particular. They tend, not just with pans, but they tend to go to the very smallest vessel they think the amount of food will hold. And it's like, you know, first of all, you can use a great big bowl if you're not, even if you're not going to fill it up.
Right.
I've tried to get people, I've tried to get people loosened up about just the size of their vessels, the size of the utensils they use. For some reason, they just think really small.
I think they think that, you know, it will be less dishwashing if they use the smaller one. If you use a big one, that means you've got more to wash.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, that is a big part of cooking.
Psychology, right? Exactly.
Yeah, cleaning up is a lot of it. How today... Do you see an influence in your mom's cooking in what you're doing today?
Well, yes. I mean, I still use fresh vegetables. I still use
sure.
fresh
sure.
ingredients. I mean, I still cook from scratch. I'm not a open up a soup can and mm-hmm. dump at all. But there's a lot of that that's still out there. I'd say that there is three or four. Yeah, she taught me how to braise food,
okay.
to do deep braising, you know, uh-huh. really get meat dark and full of caramelization mm-hmm. before you start adding liquid.
So you learn both ingredients and techniques.
Yes.
That is great. What a great gift that is. How about you?
Yeah. Well,
you talked about your ability to keep things separate, see a lot of
that. Food. Well, and I started baking like when I was about 10,
mm-hmm.
so that was really fun. Like, I work with young people now, like, in their early 20s or so, who work for me. And, you know, they don't, if I say, don't forget you have to cream the butter and sugar, they don't really know what that
means.
They haven't really done that.
Yeah.
So there's a lot of, and I feel like, well, that's pretty basic. But, you know, it is a patchwork of experience that people have.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like, for instance, one person who didn't know what that meant, I mean, she can make great, like, fish tacos or whatever. She knows how to season the mm-hmm. fish perfectly for that. So it's just really the different skill levels in all different, you know, it's, I feel like I have gaps in my education because I didn't go to culinary school. So mm-hmm. I learned on the job. I was an apprentice baker in my late teens and early 20s. I worked under a chef in Philadelphia area, and I learned a lot of baking techniques, but I didn't learn a lot about meats or any, you know.
But you know, there are people in the world of food and restaurants who think that, and I'm one of them, who think that the best cooks don't go to culinary school.
Absolutely, I agree. Well,
I kind of agree, but there are, can be gaps. That's all I'm
and
saying.
And you can fill in those gaps. True. Like I had when I started out, and
or ignore them.
Finally, functioning as a chef, I was functioning as a chef. I didn't really have great knife skills.
All right.
You know, and that's a gap you can fill in. And I
that
filled it in.
Sure.
I can teach knife skills now.
Right.
But
right.
That was a gap I had to fill in, and there were some other gaps I had to fill in. But there's, I know several restaurateurs. If you've gone to Culinary Academy or the CIA, they will not hire you.
Oh, that's true.
Absolutely. They're good for hotel cooking. But they tend to turn out, they tend to be cookie cutter in their approach to cooking and their approach to taste. They think inside the box they were taught in.
Right.
And that is, I think, a real disadvantage unless you want a career in a hotel restaurant.
Right. Right.
So,
and
good for you.
And other ones will take their skills and go so far out the box, and all they want to do is be the next
famous
Food Network star.
Yes.
They want to be famous, and they want to be the famous chef. And that's another reason why a lot of them are not hired. Yeah.
And
you know,
there's a lot of them that are going to be spending the next 30 years working the line to pay off the amazing student loans they took out to get their terrible education. And on that note, the hour is gone.
Yes.
We didn't even get a chance to go to our other... Oh, tell us real quickly. We've got time. We've got a minute.
I was going to pass around a piece of smoked tofu for everyone.
Oh, okay. Smoked tofu.
This is actually just a little sampler of some things that I made today. Nothing was really quite finished because we don't finish things till tomorrow and for the Tuesday deliveries. But I did get the tofu smoked today, and I kind of started in the oven. And I guess I should give it to you, Michelle, first.
No, you don't have to give it to me first. People are not going to believe that I'm eating tofu.
Oh, right. Well,
is that another one of those things you don't eat, Michelle?
Tofu? It's organic tofu. This is really the best tofu that
great
I make.
Smoky flavor.
Really that is great smoky flavor.
Great smoky flavor. And the texture is not yucky.
Right.
Did you press it?
Yes, I pressed it.
Yeah.
And it has Bragg's liquid aminos, which is kind of a soy thing. And then if you want to pass that along, I'm sorry, I didn't mean to.
It's actually good. I can't believe I'm saying that. I'm eating tofu.
Well, you know what? That's one thing I pride myself on is making food that people say, "Well, I really have never liked mushrooms, or I've never liked XYZ, but this is okay or good."
I'm never going to like mushrooms.
You already said you ate
I bet I could make you like mushrooms.
Okay, Marielle.
I challenge you sometimes. And on that note, it's lindysays.com. It's
LINDYSEZ.
And it's
Ruthie's
Real Meals with a Y and no apostrophe. Thank you so much. It went so fast.
Thanks.
And
thanks
meet me here
you
next
for
week
me
for another yummy episode of Mouthfuls. Talk about food, wine, and farming here on KRCB. Happy Mother's Day and have a great week.
I got over you just long enough to let my heartache mend.